subjects in mind for tonight. I'll start with one. If I don't get to the second one, it's okay. And if I run out of juice in the first one, then we can always move to the second one. So it's not working? They say you have to flip it and it's not working. So I mean, maybe
it's not.
He just said don't flip it.
Don't flip it after you do.
Okay. So just sit there. Dead. Okay.
You have to read
what you
said the right way.
He
said, do not flip it.
Yeah, that's right.
You
know
what you pay for.
That's right. Free advice is worth what you pay for it. There is a lot in the world which gives pleasure. And frankly, one of the benefits of education, right kind of education, is so you can get more pleasure. There are beautiful things to look at, if only you know where to look. I'm aware of this very vividly because my wife taught me where to look, and before she taught me, a lot of the world was blank for me. And since she taught me, each day has in it a very significant extra measure of pleasure because she taught me how to look at it. It was there, but I just didn't know how to look at it. And once she taught me how to look at it, it's just like changed the whole quality of my, you know, of my day. Now, are we supposed to enjoy these things? Does the Kodesh Baruch Hu want us to enjoy these things? Is pleasure part of the Kodesh Baruch Hu's plan? Is it something that we should look for or think of as natural or positive? Is it positive for itself? Is it a crutch? What kind of role is pleasure supposed to play in the life of a Torah Yid? A Jew wants to live by the laws of the Torah and the values of the Torah. How does pleasure fit in, if at all? This is a showstopper. Try this in your other shiur. Try this with your other teachers. This is a showstopper. This is not an easy thing. Now, I want you to hand out the brown books for a second. But I'll show you something. Ten books. I accept the correction.
Of course, that's what I heard. I was saying that loud.
You know, one of my weaknesses is my color perception. I really find it difficult to tell the differences between shade of color. So I always ask my wife, you know, what color is this really? She tells me. Okay. Find this. Where do they hide it here? Oh, here we are. 248. Oh, I'm missing the page. Let's see now. We got a second. No, I don't think it's here. Let's see. Oh, here it is. Okay. On page 228, it is there. But there's no 229 to read the translation. That was the problem over there. Okay. Well, you'll have it. The fourth one from the bottom. Upon seeing fruit trees in bloom during the spring, a couple of months we'll be making this blessing session. Blessed are you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, for nothing is lacking in His universe. That's not bad. And He created in it good creatures and good trees to cause mankind pleasure with them. This is a very strong statement. He created good creatures and good trees, and you know why He created them? So that people should have pleasure from them. Lahanos behem b'nei adam. To make people have pleasure through them. I guess if that's what He created them for, then that must be good. And it's not limited to trees. Brios tovos, ve'ilanos tovim. Good trees, yes, but in a more general statement. Good creatures. So, certainly, seems appropriate to enjoy fruits, and to enjoy the beauty of the trees, and to smell the blossoms, to have a lovely fragrance, the shade of the trees, and also, and whatever gives you pleasure, butterflies, and forests, and the sea, and the sunrise, and the sunset, and now, what would be the mitzvah here? What would be the ruchnius here, the spirituality here? What would be the positive value of these things? I was supposed to think, you know, like a kind of, on the model of an earthly parent, parents are happy when their children are happy, more or less, you know. If they're happy inserting a new virus into my computer, then I'm not going to be so happy, you know. Let's see if Dad can get this one. Ha-ha! You know, this one will eat up the hard drive in 2.4 seconds. Let's see him stop this one. They're licking their chops, thinking of the destruction of my software. And I don't think that will make me happy. No, okay. But it isn't pleasure. Parents usually are happy when their children are happy. I was supposed to think now that Kadosh Baruch Hu is making us happy because He just likes it when we're happy. It's just something He wants us to do, just be happy. How should we ever think about pleasure? We see that pleasure is one of the reasons that Kadosh Baruch Hu does things. He makes things so that we should have pleasure. But why does He want us to have pleasure? Is it an end to itself, or does it serve some other purpose? Ask yourself, in your experience of pleasure, what would be an element of ruchnius? Where would the ruchnius come out?
Karasatov.
How about a karasatov? Saying thank you. Simply saying thank you. That in itself makes the pleasure a bridge. One of the reasons parents provide pleasures for their children is to cement the relationship with their child. Here, at the very least, when a person receives a pleasure and says, thank you for providing with that pleasure becomes a bridge linking the person to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So we're not taking the pleasure in and of itself, just having the pleasure. But we think of the pleasure as a means to ruchnius. What does ruchnius mean? That's a whole shiur, but I'll give you the short and sweet of it. Ruchnius means relating to Kadosh Baruch Hu, relating to Kadosh Baruch Hu in the appropriate way. That's what ruchnius is. That's our definition of ruchnius. I wouldn't say that every culture and every religion would agree on its definition. They are different concepts. But our definition of ruchnius is connecting to Kadosh Baruch Hu in the appropriate way. An appropriate way, if more than one. So, to leave the pleasure by itself, not to look for the ruchnius connection, is to leave it on the level of an animal. It means it is to deprive it of its value. For us, all value is ruchnis. There is nothing more than ruchnis. Ruchnis is the whole. So we can't imagine that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created these things to give pleasure to human beings so as to make them into cows. On the other hand, if He created these things to give us pleasure, it means we're not going to get the ruchnis without pleasure. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't give us throwaways. Pleasure has a necessary role in ruchnis. A person who turns his back on pleasure altogether is a person who's turning his back on ruchnis, because without some level of pleasure, you're not going to have ruchnis. I stress this because many people who I think ultimately are influenced by Christianity, even though they don't know it, feel that pleasure and ruchnis are opposites.
What's the idea of preciousness?
Of what?
Precious
from motarot. Motarot means superfluous things. Things that aren't necessary means things that can't be used for ruchni. Correct. If they don't have any contribution to the ruchni, then indeed, then you're back to the cow. But if you're, there's a Yerushalmi that says, I will have to give a din b'cheshbon on every pleasure that I passed up that I could have had. What does it mean, din b'cheshbon? The din b'cheshbon means you'll have to explain why you passed it up. You'll have to explain why you didn't think it could help you. You'll have to explain why it wasn't useful for your ruchnias. If it wasn't useful for your ruchnias, or it was to endanger your ruchnias, you're right to pass it up. But you need a din b'cheshbon. You can't turn your back on a pleasure and expect that that will be automatically okay. No, you turned your back on a pleasure, you turned your back on something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put in the world. You need a reason for that. And the positive side is, it's put there and He created these things for you to have pleasure, then that means that it's a necessary element in a life of ruchnias. And a person who doesn't take what is needed of pleasure for that life of ruchnias is not fulfilling the ruchni potential that he has. Let me just add one more illustration and I'll take your question. What is Oneg Shabbos? What kind of pleasure?
Physical pleasure.
It's physical pleasure. Oneg Shabbos is physical pleasure. The mitzvah of Oneg Shabbos expresses itself in, basically, the sudos, the meals. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan has a wonderful proof that we're really talking about physical pleasure here. I don't know if you know this din. Suppose a person, God forbid, Friday night has a bad dream, a very bad, disturbing dream, something terrible. There is a halacha called Ta'anis Chalom. A person who has a bad dream fasts in order to counteract the dream. Fasts on the day when he wakes up from the dream. Can you make a Ta'anis Chalom on Shabbos? All right, there's a mitzvah of owning Shabbos. If you make a Ta'anis Chalom, you're not going to be able to eat the meals. So the Shulchan Aruch says, yes, you can make a Ta'anis Chalom on Shabbos and not eat. But since you sacrificed the mitzvah on Shabbos, you have to fast another day during the week because of the mitzvah of Onik Shabbos that you gave up. That's halach, double jeopardy. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan asks, suppose someone wakes up Shabbos morning and, God forbid, has an upset stomach. His stomach is in such pain, and he's so nauseous, that he just can't eat. He can't eat. He just can't put anything down. And in Eila, he goes the whole week, he goes the whole Shabbos day, and he eats nothing. So in the end, he fasted the whole Shabbos day. Does he have to fast, another fast during the week, to make up for the mitzvah of Onik Shabbos that he missed? Says the Aruch HaShulchan, no. He does not. What's the difference? The difference is this. A person who has a bad dream, and he's so upset that he decides he doesn't want to eat, he wants to make a tainus, he's depriving himself of Oneg Shabbos. He's depriving himself of that pleasure. He's decided, I'm not going to eat, because I'm too worried about the halot. If he ate the chillin, he'd enjoy it. He'd just feel bad because he's worried about the dream. In other words, he's capable of owning Shabbos. He's capable of it. He's decided something else is more important. So he's decided to give up owning Shabbos. For that, even when it's right to do it, he has to pay the penalty of fasting again during the week. But the guy with the upset stomach, Sefer HaShulchan, he can't do owning Shabbos. He's not deciding to give up the mitzvah of owning Shabbos. He's not physically capable of it. He's onus. He's caused by a power beyond his control that he can't do the mitzvah of Onik Shabbos. Then, says the Aruch HaShulchan, then he says you don't have to make it up. What's impossible for you, you don't have to make up. What does it show you? It shows you that Onik Shabbos is dafka, the physical pleasure. Because the person with the bad dream, who's emotionally upset, and it's going to make him very anxious and upset and worried to eat the chulent, we say, still, the mitzvah of Onik Shabbos is possible for you. Why? He's going to be anxious, upset, and worried, but his stomach will feel good. His stomach will feel good, so he could still do the mitzvah. He's just deciding not to. Whereas the person with an upset stomach, he can't take the food. So the mitzvah of Onik Shabbos is physical pleasure. And what the Navi, and Chazal, who took it from the Navi, are saying is that without the physical pleasure, you can't have the full Ruchnius of Shabbos. This is an amazing statement. Without meat, and good challah, and good wine, and good schnapps, you don't get the Ruchnius of Shabbos. This is a point of view that other religions will find very difficult to understand. How can you mix the Ruchni and Gashmi like that, the physical and the spiritual? But for us, physical pleasure under certain conditions is a necessary ingredient in the Ruchni. So a person will say, oh, I'm stronger than that, precious, you know, I'm going to cut myself off, then he's going to lose a mitzvah, the mitzvah of owning Shabbos, and owning Yavtav, and other things as well. So pleasure has a necessary role to play as a positive part of a person's ruchnius, whether it's hakaras hatov or whether it's appreciating the quality of a certain type of kedusha, type of holiness, a certain type of time. And that's why pleasure is a necessary part of ruchnius. This is part of the question. You have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering. When you ask when you go up and you ask, why did you go to Niagara Falls? It's a beautiful sight, or wherever in the world. Can you sometimes have a valid answer like, I would have loved Hashem, but I had the mitzvah to live in Israel, and then therefore Hashem's like asking a question, just like so you can give an answer.
But I don't know the script in all of Mador of exactly what they ask you and what they're doing.
Can you have an excuse?
But of course you can have an excuse. But the point here is that you need an excuse. You need an excuse. If you need an excuse, then you're already admitting there's something over there that's good. And if I didn't take it, I have to have an excuse. Sometimes there is an excuse. I was doing something else that was better. But the very fact that you need an excuse shows you that that thing is good. Otherwise, you wouldn't need an excuse at all. Simply say, why should I do it? Now, Rav Shem Shmuel Hirsch, I don't know if this is written anywhere, but it has been quoted in his name by responsible people. Then he said that after 120, anybody who lives in Europe, God will ask him, did you see my Alps? My Alps, the mountains. Did you see my Alps? Why should anybody go to see those mountains? Because they're so overwhelmingly beautiful that when you see them, you think to yourself, you put this immense, overwhelming beauty in your universe, and you give thanks and praise to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for it. So experiencing that beauty becomes a bridge. And you've heard from other people how impressive it is. So you know that if you would see it, it would be that kind of bridge to relating to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Nusach HaShemarucha says, I put it in the world for you to use that way. Why didn't you use it? Why didn't you take advantage of it? Now, like he says, if the guy has to, look, I'm a Rosh Hashanah, you know, I'm spending all my time teaching Torah to Talmidim, so HaShemarucha will say, okay, fine, I understand. That may be more important than seeing the Alps. But you need an excuse. What were you doing that was more important? If you don't have something, then HaShemarucha will say, it was there, why didn't you see it? By the way, living in Eretz Yisrael is an excellent excuse. You don't leave Eretz Yisrael to go see the Alps. That's not a valid reason to see the Alps.
I think it was the
Vilna
of Gaon, who would eat bread and water, and it was very simple, and he would, sometimes I heard, I don't know if it was Vilna of Gaon, but this one particular rabbi that I heard, the Gadol Hador, wouldn't chew the food to derive pleasure out of the texture or taste. It was just straight white bread or challah or whatever it was, with water, and that was enough sustenance. I thought it was the Vilna of Gaon.
Look, there can always be people who are trying to achieve something special, certainly at a certain period of time in their lives, and that special thing can take precedence over other things. But you cannot bring a proof from that of what everybody should do under all circumstances.
Yeah, but why would a Gadol HaDor do that, and specifically with the intention of limiting the physical pleasures in this world, focusing on the Ruchnius? Without the pleasure as a bridge.
Well, first of all, I want to know if he did it on Shabbos and Yom Tov also. I doubt it very much. Secondly, you don't know what particular battle he's fighting. For example, Rav Desta writes, Hillel, the Gemara tells us, was a woodchopper. And he was so poor, he didn't have the penny to pay to go into the Beis Medrash. That's the famous thing where they found him on the skylight. You know the story? Right, he froze up there at wintertime. Now, Vesta asks, Hillel is a brilliant person, right? A genius. Couldn't he have gotten a job working for an entrepreneur, some kind of person with a big business, and give him business advice for a couple of hours a day, and earn enough money, and then go to the Beis Medrash and learn? Why would he chop wood? In fact, you'll tell me, well, Hillel was so brilliant, he could learn by memory. I'm sure he could, but that's not the same as sitting at Beis Medrash and learning with other people. So why did he give up high-powered Talmud Torah for the sake of chopping wood? Says Rav Dessler, he was working on his midos. He was working on his character development. In particular, he was working on his chesed, on his loving kindness. And he had a certain program why chopping wood would be the best thing for him to do. So the question is, so what? So what? So he's working on his loving kindness. So what? Isn't Talmud Torah, Keneged Kulam, as important as everything else? He's the foundation. Now, if you can bring in the Rosh Yeshiva, you know, and whip it up and say, you know, Talmud Torah is more important than everything else. So what was Hillel doing? The answer is, for a life of serving the Kodesh Baruch Hu, a foundation of loving kindness is where you start. And yes, you give up months, or maybe years, of learning in Yeshiva in order to set that foundation. Now, I don't say that's true for everybody. Wouldn't say that's true for everybody. It just shows you, for certain people, how the priorities could be reversed. So here, if you tell me that the Vilna Gaon did this, that isn't true. This is true for everybody, right? For his particular spiritual goals, this happened to be the appropriate thing. Again, what did I say? I quoted Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi says that for every pleasure you passed up, you have to give an accounting. It doesn't say that you were always wrong. Doesn't say you're necessarily wrong, but you have to give an accounting. So I assume that Vilna Gaon would have been able to give an accounting. Right? But that accounting wouldn't work for everybody. It worked for him. Doesn't work for everybody else. Yeah.
Well, would you say that a great, I don't know, I mean, let's say you go ahead and just the opposite, you flew all around the world, you saw all the beautiful sights, you priced a large quantity of time just admiring different types of beauty in the world besides the Alps. You want to go back and you're a lunar Italy. So, but you, and you say Torah, so how's a lifestyle like that? You know, would you have to make excuses to say, is that a great way to connect the Ruchnius and get the rest of both worlds? So you say Torah and
I think
the Ruchnius by traveling the world and checking out sites.
See, this is really quite important. When you say that something is valuable, it doesn't follow that alone all the time would be valuable. It means it's an element in life. You know, vitamins are good for you, but not if you take 26 pills a day. That's not going to be good for you. And if you decide to survive just on vitamins, that also is not going to be good for you. Vitamins are good as a dietary supplement. You know, one or two a day, very nice. That could be useful to you.
You're comparing vitamins to, like, pleasure.
I'm comparing vitamins to the house.
Yeah.
Right? Once or twice a year might be good to add to your inspiration to have a couple of days seeing something that's beautiful. But that leaves you 361 to do other things. I'm comparing vitamins to your diet like the Alps to the rest of your life. It's a nice supplement. It's a nice accompaniment. It's a nice spice. But don't confuse it for the bread and potatoes, meat and potatoes. Okay. Now, in addition, pleasure can be a means to a life of ruchnius. Many have written about this, in particular, Shiori Das. A certain amount of pleasure is necessary for a person to have a well-balanced psychology. If a person's always depriving himself, he's always cutting himself short, he's always running himself into the ground, he's always putting himself through stress and strain and pain, that's going to have a bad effect on his character in general, and that's going to spill over to the way he fulfills mitzvot. Here are a few of the dangers that people get into if they do too much of this. You meet people, you interact with people. How do you treat them? Are you irritable? Short? Nervous? Do you have time for other people? Do you have space for other people? Can you think about what other people need? Can you look deeply enough into them to see what they're feeling and respond to what they're feeling? If they're feeling down, can you offer them help? If they're feeling up, can you offer to share the celebration with them? A person who's putting himself under too much strain, a person who's depriving himself too much, a person who's under all the time, is going to find it very difficult to relate to other people. A person who's basically happy, basically satisfied, has room to think about other people. A person who's basically in pain, basically deprived, basically under, finds it very difficult to relate to other people, to give to other people, to be sensitive to other people. And the Torah wants that of us. To love someone is to be interested in his welfare and sensitive and try to help. Imagine Shabbos. Imagine a person really down on himself, really hard on himself. It comes Shabbos. Only Shabbos. Okay, how much? Just the bare minimum. I'm not stepping over the line. Okay, let's see. Wine. Well, let's see. The Golan Wineries has three grades. There's the Golan, and then there's the Yarden, and the Gamla. Right? Now, Gamla is the worst, and Golan, I think, is second, and Yarden is the first. Oh, God, I take Yarden. That's just, you know, that's extravagant. It's very delicious, but it's extravagant. Okay, only Shabbos is very nice, but why go, you know? Let's see. Two or three. I can get by on three. I don't really need two. You know, and then when you drink it, you think, it's okay, I guess. That's wine. Nothing special. So then, what happens to your only Shabbos? What happens to your pleasure of Shabbos? What happens to your hakaras hatov, your gratitude to Kadosh Baruch Hu for the mitzvah and the onig of Shabbos? Well, the wine was okay, I guess, boss. You know, wasn't anything special. So then, that mitzvah is losing. And the hakaras hatov, the gratitude is losing. So, as a means to the ruchnius, how about a person who's tense about something? He's worried about something. And he knows for himself that a good 2 hours playing tennis and he'll feel better. We've talked about sports and physical activity. Physical activity is very good for you. It's even good for your psychology. It's not only good for your muscles, your coordination, your speed. It's good for your psychology. It makes you a more relaxed person. Even your blood pressure comes down, as I've discovered in the last 6 months. And when you're a more relaxed person and a more satisfied person, so you relate to other people differently, your davening is different, your davening is calmer, and it's more focused. So, physical pleasure can be a way to improve the quality of the mitzvos that you do. And that's the case. It is a necessary ingredient in a ruchni life. Now, of course, anything could be overdone. That was the analogy with the Alps. Anything could be overdone. But from the fact that it could be overdone, shouldn't lead you to the opposite extreme, where you do nothing. A certain amount is definitely necessary. Everybody with me? Okay, good. That was the first point that I wanted to make. Now let's move to the second point to see if I can get this across in 25 minutes. Suppose somebody said to you, you are totally selfish. You're totally selfish. You haven't got an altruistic hair on your head, let alone bone in your body. Bones are too big. You haven't got an altruistic hair on your head. You never, ever did or do or will do anything for anybody else. Everything you do only for yourself. So, of course, you answered him, get out of my space because I'm going to blow you away. What do you mean? You know, what a gross insult. I never do anything for anybody else. See, he says, I'll prove it to you. Because think, everything you do because you want to do it. Isn't that true? Is there anything you do that you don't want to do? That's all. If you do it, so it's got to be. You did it for a reason, and the reason has to be somewhere that you wanted it. You wanted something out of it. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. No, so that means it's selfish, right? You did it because you wanted to do it. Obviously, if you had no desire to do it at all, you wouldn't do it. The reason you do it is because you have some desire that wants it. No, so that means you did it because you wanted to. If you did it because you wanted to, so then it's always selfish. And he pushes on. I'll give you another proof. Take anything you do. Now, when you do it, you're trying to accomplish something. Sometimes you succeed and sometimes you fail. Let's take the case where you succeed. Well, fail is a special item. But let's take a case where you try to do something and succeed. How does it make you feel? Doesn't it make you feel good? Whatever it is. Whatever it is. You set yourself a goal to do something and you do it. I'm going to teach my 8-year-old cousin how to play chess. So I sit with him and I teach him the rules and I teach him some of the strategies and he becomes a moderate player. Who's benefiting here? Well, he's certainly benefiting. He's learning how to play chess. But how do I feel when he plays chess? Don't I feel terrific? Look at that. I taught him how to play chess and he's doing well. I feel terrific. So the critic says, see? You did it. You succeeded and you feel terrific. That's what I said. You did it for yourself. Are you with me? Now this is all wrong. What I've told you is all wrong. As persuasive as it sounds, and as natural as it sounds, and as convincing as it sounds, it's all wrong. What do I mean it's wrong? It is true, as he says, if you do it, it must be because you wanted to do it. That's true. And it is true, as he says, that if you try to do something and you succeed, you're going to feel good about it. Both of those are true, but they have nothing to do with whether it's selfish. His two observations are correct, but the conclusion just doesn't follow. That has nothing to do with whether or not it's selfish. Because he has the wrong picture of selfishness. That's where he starts. His starting point is wrong. The very first step is wrong. Selfishness is where I do it for the goal of my own pleasure. and my own benefit. Selfishness is where I do it for the goal of my own pleasure and my own benefit. And nothing the critic has said leads to that conclusion. It's true I do it because I want to do it. Because I want to do it. But we haven't said anything else, anything yet about what I want to do and what my goal is. It's true that when I do it, I feel good. That doesn't yet say that the feeling good is why I did it. It doesn't say that it was the goal of doing it. It just says that I do feel good. But it doesn't say that that was the goal. The two things the critic points out are both true, but they have nothing to do with the conclusion he was advertising. Do I do it because I want to? Yes. Do I get a good feeling when I succeed? Yes. Does that mean that I did it for the good feeling? Not at all. Not at all. That's a different proposition. It has nothing to do with the first two. And indeed, the first two could be true and the second one could be false. Let me give you an illustration, and then I'll stop to take questions, and then I'll finish up. About 4 years ago, the Mississippi River overflowed in the United States. A whole bunch of floods all the way down. Some cities were flooded out. Some cities set up sandbags and protected themselves. Now let's imagine somebody in San Jose, California. And he's watching this on television. And he sees the rivers coming down. 2 days it'll be here, 5 days it'll be there, and 10 days it'll be there. And some cities are getting flooded out, and some cities are not. And he sees pictures of people working, piling up the sandbags to try to hold back the river. And he says to himself, boy, that's really tough. I mean, and those places are flooded, you know, it's tremendous destruction and disease in them. I'm going to help. So he figures out, it'll take him 2 days to drive there, and he picks a city that's a week down the path of the river, gets into his car and drives there 2 days, and offers himself as a volunteer to help stack the sandbags. And for 3 days and nights, he's there, you know, hauling the sandbags back and forth to make the wall against the water. That's what he does, and then he goes back to San Jose. A month later, he's talking about this to a friend, his experience, what it meant. And the friend says to him, listen, you were there for 3 days and three nights, and you're hauling sandbags, 100 pounds a bag. Do you think that all that hauling of sandbags increased the strength of your muscles? So he says, I guess so. I mean, you know, it was a pretty good workout, hauling 100-pound sandbags for 3 days and nights. I guess so. So, turns out, he got a benefit. Look at that. He had stronger muscles. Now, was that his goal in going to help build the wall of sandbags? Was that a goal that he had? Was it part of his purpose to go? Certainly doesn't have to be. It could very well be that he didn't even think of it. It didn't even occur to him till a month later when the guy says, listen, you know, you spent 3 days doing hard labor. Didn't that improve your muscles? He says, oh gosh, you know, I didn't think of that, but I suppose you're right. Certainly could be that he got this benefit without thinking about it, without planning on it, certainly without it being part of his goal or his purpose. So what does this case show you? It shows you that you might do something and you might get a benefit when you do it. The benefit is there. And indeed, if it's exercise, the benefit is there necessarily. It's hard to escape strengthening your muscles if you're going to exercise. And still, the benefit was not the goal. The benefit was not the purpose. You can't say, see, you're really selfish because you've got stronger biceps and triceps now. That's not going to follow. Because in his mind, in his motivation, in his psychology, the stronger muscles didn't play any role at all. That wasn't what he was after. What this shows you is you could do something and get a benefit without the benefit being your purpose. To be selfish, it has to be that the benefit for yourself was your purpose. Just pointing out that there's a benefit there doesn't do enough. You'd have to continue to show somehow that it was the person's purpose. And it doesn't have to be his purpose. Not pitom, as we say in Hebrew. Yeah.
No, I want to flip it a little. Let's say someone is sitting in San Jose and he's thinking to himself, you know, I want to get stronger. I want to do work with my muscles well. He doesn't know exactly. Maybe he'll go to the gym or maybe he'll go swimming. And he sees, look, there's a river that's flying down, it's overflowing. This is great. I'm going to go there and I'll load up sandbags. And in the course of doing that, I'll work on my muscles.
So you're 100% right. But listen, but I think what we've lost now is the point of the argument. What you're showing me is there could be a case where the motivation was selfish. I agree. There could be such cases. There are selfish people, and there are selfish motivations, and there are selfish actions. Everybody agrees to that. But what did the critics say? The critics said that everything you ever have done and ever will do always is selfish. That was his claim. His claim is there's no such thing as ever doing something for anybody else. You provided a case where it is selfish. I agree, there are selfish cases. I'm arguing that in addition to the selfish cases, there are also the generous cases. All I need is one case. You're giving a different case. Back a shot. But if my case is really a case where the benefit isn't why you did it, then the critic is already wrong. The critic's making a blanket statement supposed to cover everybody, every time, under all conditions. It's always selfish. All I need is one case to show him wrong. Colin? Yeah?
Can you give the definition of selfishness?
Yeah. Selfish means that your goal in doing it is your own benefit. That's your goal. Not just that you happen to get benefit, but it's your goal. Your purpose in doing it is to get your own benefit. Yeah.
And let's say we take pleasure from doing mitzvos. We take pleasure from putting on tefillin in the morning, or we take pleasure from davening nates, and we speak about that experience at a later time. Are we allowed to derive pleasure from something like that?
So I'll tell you that the Mishnah that everybody knows in Pirkei Avos, Schar Mitzvah Mitzvah, the reward of mitzvah of a mitzvah is another mitzvah, right? So if you look at the Bar Tanura, now looking at the Bar Tanura can be dangerous. You might learn something. But if you look at the Bar Tanura, you'll see it has two explanations. One explanation is the one that everybody says. You do a mitzvah, but in Baruch Hu will give you the opportunity to do another mitzvah, that's your reward. But the second explanation the Bar Tanura gives is this. Schar mitzvah, the reward for a mitzvah, is the benefit and pleasure you get from doing the mitzvah. And the Mishnah is telling you that the benefit and pleasure you get from doing the mitzvah is itself more mitzvah. And you get a bigger reward in Olam Haba for the fact that you got pleasure and benefit from doing the mitzvah. It's an unbelievable pshat. It's a real Hasidic pshat. Only the Baal Tanura came before Hasidim, so, you know. But we claim them, as I told you. We claim everybody who says something good, so it's certainly ours. Right? It's an unbelievable pshat. Why? Because it depends, it depends on the kind of pleasure you get. The point that I've made so far is, merely showing me that I have pleasure is not enough to convict me of selfishness. You have to show me that there was the purpose to get pleasure, that you haven't shown yet. Merely pointing out that I do it on the basis of my desire is not enough. Sure, I did it on the basis of my desire, but what did I desire? What was it the desire for? What was the goal of the desire? Could be, I did it on the basis of my desire, but my desire was to help somebody else. If so, then it's not necessarily selfish. Just being my desire doesn't convict.
Is there any problem with doing a mitzvah just for the reward you're getting alone and for no other reason?
If you do it for that reason, and that reason alone, you will get a reward in Olam Haba, and you have done the mitzvah. But there are higher levels on which it should be done. Right? So it's not bad, it's just very low good. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I'll put you the question. All right. Now,
I was going to say, if I
So the pleasure that the death that she gave out at the beginning. So. It could be when you say in the beginning, it could be that pleasure, and then you gave the only shot, right?
Yeah.
I'm not
trying to tie the two of them together. Maybe it could be done, but I'm not trying to do that yet. I thought of them as two separate points. Let's try to leave them separate, at least for the time being. I think it's going to get too complicated.
Okay.
Yeah.
My question relates to the last question. If your desire is to get a reward, Olam Haba, it's good, but it's not great. So what is it that you should, can you say like what it is that what a person should desire? Is it?
Okay, I'll come back to that. Let me just.
No question.
Okay. Let's see if I'll have time to do that. But let me make the train to the end the way I need to make it by 9:30. Now, another way to put what I'm saying is this: you get a pleasure or a benefit out of doing something. That pleasure or benefit could be a side product, a byproduct. A side effect. Be a byproduct. In other words, not the goal, it's a byproduct. It came along. But that wasn't the goal. Why is it that when you do something and you succeed, remember we said we're talking only about the case where you succeed, we're not putting in failure. Failure is a separate case. When you succeed, you always feel good about it. Because you had a desire to do it. And with your desire to do it, if you succeed, you satisfy that desire to do it. Satisfaction is a kind of pleasure. I can't get no satisfaction. There was a song like that once upon a time. Right? Satisfaction is a kind of pleasure. If I want to do something and I succeed, I'm satisfying that desire. So of course I'm going to have some pleasure in it. But if my desire was to do X, and I work hard, and I succeed, and I do X, and then, because I wanted to do X, I get the satisfaction of that desire to do X, the satisfaction is a byproduct. The desire was for X. Of course, whenever you succeed in doing what you want to do, you satisfy that desire, and you satisfy the desire, that's a pleasure. But that's only a byproduct. The thing you wanted to do was X. So the pleasure, of course, is always going to be there. But it'll be the pleasure of satisfying that desire. And that's true for any X, including a mitzvah. Including a mitzvah. A person who does a mitzvah solely for the sake of God, 100% lishma, only for the sake of the mitzvah, with no other personal motivation, will have pleasure in doing the mitzvah. When you do something lishma, only for God's sake, it doesn't mean that you don't have any pleasure. You definitely have pleasure. Because you wanted to do it for God's sake. And you succeeded in doing it for God's sake. You will have the pleasure of success in doing what you wanted to do. A life of serving the Kodesh Baruch Hu, and only serving the Kodesh Baruch Hu, for the pure reason of serving the Kodesh Baruch Hu, is not a life devoid of pleasure. On the contrary, it's a life of sublime pleasure. Because that's what the neshama really wants. And when you give the neshama what it really wants, then the neshama has tremendous pleasure from that. The pleasure of getting what it wants. So when we talk about living life for the sake of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, altruism for the sake of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, doing things with Shema, we're not talking about cutting out pleasure. And I believe, although it is not easy to push this into the words of the Bar Tanura, but I don't know how else to understand him. When he talks about the pleasure and the benefit of doing a mitzvah that makes it into a greater mitzvah, I don't think he means if you happen to earn money thereby. That's too extravagantly counterintuitive to think that that's what he means. Or, let's say, you wave a lulav and that increases your muscular strength, you know, or something like that. I don't think that's what he's talking about. But if you are the kind of person for whom mitzvahs are a thrill. Mitzvahs are a sublime, satisfaction and pleasure because you appreciate the privilege of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you feel the inspiration of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that gives you tremendous pleasure in doing the mitzvah. That does not reduce the mitzvah. That improves the mitzvah. Here's a comparison that I would give you as an example and something to think about. Parent tells a child to do something for him, for the parent. Now, one child says, oh, I have to do that. Oh, boy, what a pain in the neck. What? It's going to be such an effort and everything. Okay, I have to do it. My father asked me to do it. I owe it to him. I'm obligated to do what my father wants. I'll do it. But boy, is this a pain. And he had to struggle with himself, and it hurts, and he does it. Now, we usually say, the more it hurts, the more reward you get because you're overcoming more resistance, you're making a bigger effort, right? Now, let's imagine another son. Father tells the son to do something for him, and the son says, an opportunity to do for my father? That's wonderful. I'm so glad he just told me what he wanted, so I don't have to guess. This way I know I'm doing something important for him, and he does it with thrill and enthusiasm and energy and excitement. There's no resistance there at all. With whom will the father be more pleased? The first son who's struggling. He's struggling. And he's overcoming the pain and the effort and this, you know, with his sense of duty that I have to do this. Or with the second son who's thrilled and inspired by the opportunity to do something for his father. With which one is the father going to be more pleased? Even more pleased with the second. Because the second shows enormous love. Enormous love and appreciation for his father. That's what makes it easy. That's what makes it pleasurable for him. What makes it pleasurable for him is how close he feels to his father. How inspired he feels by his father. That's far higher than a person who feels no inspiration at all, does it out of a sense of duty, and feels the pain of the strain of having to do it, but overcomes the pain anyway. Now the second son is not bad. And he's better than the third son who says, oh, that's easy. Oh, boy, am I glad he asked me for something easy. Yeah, because I can just whip that off. Because if it had been hard, I don't know if I'd been able to do it. But this way, it's something easy, he just whips it off. So, of the three, the one for whom it's easy and trivial, and he treats it as easy and trivial, is the worst. The one who struggles against his resistance is better. But the one for whom it's an inspiration and a joy to serve his father is surely the best. That is the way I think you should understand the Bar Tanura. That kind of pleasure in doing the mitzvah, because it's a joy and a privilege to be able to serve God, that kind of joy does not detract from the mitzvah, it adds to the mitzvah. And there, clearly, that's not the purpose for which he does it. He's not doing it for the pleasure. He's doing it because serving God is really the highest thing that he wants. And because he gets the highest thing that he wants, he gets the sublime pleasure out of it. But the pleasure is a byproduct. It's not his goal. And since it's not his goal, it doesn't qualify as selfish. Questions? Yeah?
What do you mean doing it for God's sake?
Well, I'll try, but I don't know how far I can take this. You look at the world, certain things are more important, certain things are less important. At least that's the way they strike you. Some things affect a lot of people and some things affect a few people. Some things affect what's really important about people and some things affect things that are much less important about people. There are two competing television channels. And on one channel, they're giving instructions how to avoid the plague. And another channel, they're showing war scheme. And there's sudden interference between the two channels. And you can flip the switch to decide which channel should be shown. And since people are dying of the plague, so you say, well, I think it's more important for people to know how to avoid the plague than it is for the watch water scheme. So I'll flip it that way. And these are sort of natural judgments that we make about what's important and what's not important, right? Now, when a person appreciates what the options are, and he sees that this is what the creator of the universe wants done so that the whole creation can be perfected, there's nothing more important than that. There's nothing more important. So number one, I do it because it's the most important thing that needs to be done. Number two, I feel a tremendous sense of privilege that I have the opportunity to do that. You know, other people are collecting the garbage, and I can flip the switch and helping people to be saved from the plague. I feel that I've been given a very important role to play, and I'm doing something very important for other people. Here I can help bring the universe to its perfection, from which the whole human race, past, present, and future, will benefit. That's an enormous privilege and opportunity. And then it also cements my relationship to God, my correct connection to God, which brings me more joy than anything else. So, because that's what he wants to do. He wants me to have that relationship with him. So this becomes objectively the most important thing that I can do for the world and for myself. That's what I mean.
That's for God's sake?
Yes, for the sake of the importance of the thing. Right. Because he is the most important thing there is. Yeah.
So, we shouldn't feel guilty for doing
with pleasure,
because that's right. You're talking about
Correct. Of course, like the Alps, it shouldn't be all day, every day, you know. But the fact that there is pleasure in my life, that's a positive thing. And it's not something that one should feel guilty about. That is quite correct.
So this is a response
to someone
says,
oh,
I need pleasure.
That's right. That's right. Now here you have five tapes of it. Yeah. The response is on plastic. Yeah.
My father is fond of saying, you have to be good to yourself. So is this idea helping that statement, the idea about pleasure without selfishness, if it's going to help you in your service to Hakadosh Baruch Hu,
clarify
your mind, so...
That's exactly, as a means. Just add those three words on to your father's statement, and I think it will be perfect. Yes, you have to be good to yourself as a means, correct.
But then my surrogate fathers, the Rebbeim here at the yeshiva, when they say, you should come to shir, and I say, well, I'd really like to, you know, take a few minutes to myself and go jog up around the block, and well, you really do belong in shir. You know, at the expense of, say, learning, do we take more consideration?
Well, let's see. I assume that your schedule is that you're in shir 14 hours a day?
No comment.
Gosh, then maybe you could find the few minutes to jog without taking them out of shir. Nobody says you shouldn't jog, but unless you're really studying around the clock, you know, you could probably find some minutes to, yeah. Then you have a problem. Unless you're Rabbi Akiva or you're the Legon or something else, you probably shouldn't be. Because you'll burn out. You'll burn out, and then you'll, in the long run, you'll get less. A person has to pace himself. He has to pace himself. Now, when you've been doing it for a few years, and you know your own capacity, but I think the danger of burnout can be anywhere, and a person has to be aware. He has to be careful of himself. Finds himself becoming irritable. He can't tolerate his chavrusa's criticisms, because his chavrusa, after all, is really dumb today. And I know for sure that he doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? You have to monitor yourself and see what the consequences are. And it can be too much. It can be too much. And especially in the beginning section, I recommend getting out of here a couple of hours a day, clear your head, go for a run, play soccer, you know, swim, get some air into your body and read something light or listen to music, or just don't be, you're not capable of handling it. You're just not capable of handling it.
How do you know what a lot of time you have left? Say, you have a year or a year and a half, and maybe you'll get
another. It doesn't matter, because it's self-defeating to do more. You'll end up with less even over a year or 6 months, because the quality will go down. The quality of what you're able to do will go down. So that even over 6 months, you push yourself very hard for a month, and for the last 5 months, your whole quality is going down. In the end, you're a loser. Yeah.
Hi, sorry to be vague. There's an idea that to perform mitzvah for its own sake, and there's a story about a particular rav which describes this point. I can't remember who he was, but it was the incident with the etrog.
Yeah. But not for the sake of the reward. So they tell it about different people, about the Vilna Gaon, about other people. But I don't see what the point of it is here. They say that maybe it was the Vilna Gaon, so there was a shortage of esrogim that year, and he sent his shamash with a certain bag of money, and find me an esrog, I don't care where it is, you know, get it for me. So he scoured the whole area, and there was only one rich person in some place who had an esrog. So he got there, and he said, listen, I'm an emissary of the Vilna Gaon, and I want the esrog. He wants the esrog, I'll pay for it. So the guy first said, no, I mean, I paid for it, I want the mitzvah. And then finally he said, okay, I'll give you the esrog, but on one condition. That Vilna Gaon gets the esrog, and he does the mitzvah, and I get the reward. So the shamash, you know, couldn't check my cell phone. Is that the addition that you're willing to accept, or not accept? So he, on his own responsibility, decided he'll take it. I forget whether he gave him money or didn't give him money. Anyway, he comes back with the esrog, and he says to the Vilna Gaon, look, he gave it to me, but he only gave it to me on this condition that you could do the mitzvah, but you can't have the reward. You've got to give the reward to him. So the Vilna Gaon is supposed to have taken the esrog and got up and started to dance and said, this finally gives me an opportunity to do a mitzvah l'shmo. Mitzvah for its own sake, because I know that I have no desire for the reward, seeing as I'm not going to get any reward. Okay, I have some worries about the story and worries about the logic. But let's just take the part that applies to us. Did that increase or decrease his pleasure in doing the mitzvah?
Increased.
Obviously increased it. It increased it. Because he wants to serve a Kodesh Baruch Hu l'shma, out of love, for its own sake. And this is giving him an opportunity where he knows that he can't have any other motivation because he's not going to get anything outside of it. So the pleasure for him is more intense. That doesn't make it selfish. I don't know. The pleasure is intense as a byproduct of his desire to do it for no goal, for no gain. And he's getting what he wants. He's got an opportunity to do it for no gain. So that's a good example of how a very selfless action can produce very intense pleasure. Okay.
Huh?